The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right. Welcome to a Monday, everybody. It's a brand new week. Yeah, you know, there's so many different ways we could go with it, but it's Monday, and wow, there's a lot going on. So, you know, this morning when I awoke, I was thinking, who should I have on the show to talk about everything that's happening? I mean, because it's going to be like a news roundup-y kind of a day, and I thought, you know, my wish list, number one on my wish list is the... is David Dayen, because he is, I'm telling you, for as long as I've been doing this program, he has been the most prolific news writer that I know of. I mean, back in the old days, he was doing the news for Fire Dog Lake. Who remembers that? And these days, he is executive editor of the American Prospect. You can find them online at prospect.org, and they are so good. So good. So my cover photo today, you know, every day I try to put out, make a graphic to represent the show. And today, because it's a little bit of everything, I thought, let me show you what I did over the weekend. And so it's a photo from the big immersive room at that immersive Van Gogh exhibit that I went to this with David and I went to this weekend. So here I'll put that picture back up, but in a moment I'll show you a little bit of video. It was very cool. I'd go back. I'm dating myself here, but if when you were a kid, you maybe ever tripped, that's what this room was like. This immersive room. So when you first go in, there's all kinds of, you go basically through a gallery, and they're not the original paintings. They're reproductions of paintings, but they've got a lot of cool little feature things. And like I said, very, very trippy things. So let's see if I can't, here, let me put this, see if this works. This video of, I'm just going to play a video shot. And for those of you who are, not watching video, I'll try to explain to you what it is. So this is, I don't even know the name of the painting. It's not Starry Night. That's the other one. But this is the one that often goes with Starry Night. Oh, I don't have, hold on. I know you don't have audio. I know you don't have audio on that shot. Hold on, I'm fixing. I did some adjustments to my system this weekend, and I know... there's a new microphone input, and so it was not on that shot. So let me get it there so that I can go back to that, and you'll hear me talking when I play this quick video. So anyway, this is from, you go through like the gallery area, and there's a lot of interactive stuff and a lot of, things to read about Van Gogh and his life and the different phases. And then you go in this immersive room where it's massive walls, you know, wall to ceiling projections. And just to give you an example for those watching, I don't have the music going, is you can't even hear it. The music, just in case, it was like classical music. It was good. And then you hear a voice, but basically the paintings sort of come to life. So this is one, it's like on the river. I feel bad. I don't know the name of this painting. It kind of goes with the Starry Night painting. Then there are these lovely sayings. Color itself speaks its own language. You cannot live without it. So a lot of inspirational messages. But I just loved that the boats are moving on the water. The other thing that I found fascinating was that masks were required to get in, as they should be, because right now we are in the COVID, the fourth surge, it seems, and this Delta variant is really bad. And of course, you know, for some reason, the media is like complicit in shilling for moron death sentence, but Florida has a full 20% of the new cases. One in five new cases in this country are coming from Florida. And yet this idiot started putting out merchandise, T-shirts and koozies, you know, the things that you put your beer can in that say, don't Fauci my Florida. Ugh. I say, don't DeSantis my Florida. So anyway, once you got inside, a lot of people just took off their masks. And for a while there, it was sort of like half and half. But I think once we got into this big room, it was probably 60-40. And the 60% were the people not wearing masks. I don't get it. You know, the idiot, the asshole part of me wants to say, I hope every single last one of them gets COVID and gets really, really sick. You know, I think about leper colonies. Maybe we need to have COVID colonies for people who refuse to get vaccinated and let them all go. So anyway, I've been letting some of the video run as I've been talking. Very trippy, right? Should you have any of those mind-altering things? Well, you might not even need them because this puts you in that mindset as it is. You go in there and all of a sudden you kind of feel kind of trippy. So anyway, that was that one. I've got others. I posted some on Facebook. Maybe I'll put a few of them on the blog today at NicoleSandler.com/7-19-21. That's where today's show will go because, you know, that's how I post each day's show. So anyway, what did I forget? Oh, the jerking off guy? Yeah, we were seated in the non-masturbation section. However, I know you think I'm kidding. The way that big room was set up, there were like benches scattered throughout the room, and it was roomy enough. You know, they allegedly had it set up. You know, they only let in so many people because of COVID. Oh, you had no audio when that was playing? Oh, shit. Sorry about that. Anyway, figures. They probably you didn't hear me talking. I'm sorry if you didn't. So they had benches set up. And they had like bean bags on the floor so you could just sit. You could lie down and look up. You could do all those kind of things, right? So we were sitting on like the side of the room, as you can tell from my vantage point in that video, looking straight ahead, there was like, it was in this gorgeous theater, which mostly was covered up, but there were some wood carvings on the walls and that's what we were seeing ahead of us. But in the middle of the room, directly across from us was another, like a circular bench in the middle, sort of like a fountain, you know, like, and people sitting around the fountain. And there was this man who was leaning back. And David and I both looked at and realized that this man had his hand down his pants. And he was there with a woman, and she seemed to not notice. But if he was just going down there to adjust, he stayed a little too long. And David and I are looking at each other and going, what the hell? What is he doing? And finally, David's like, this is nuts. He became Ken. I guess it's male Karen, and went out to get somebody and say, there's a guy jerking off. I mean, I didn't see the hand moving or anything, but how disconcerting. So his hand is down his pants. I guess he was stimulated. So he finally stopped, thank God. And at the end, so we left and we went around the corner and ate at this wonderful little Italian place that we found the last time we went to that theater. We saw Joe Jackson at the Olympia Theater in Miami, and we went to this amazing Italian restaurant. While we were walking over there, I see this guy lying down on the sidewalk. It was the same guy. You see, this is Miami. And this part, all right, so... You know, this just happened. It's just Miami. It's a weird place. But driving down there and driving back, and while we're sitting at dinner, because we sat outside, you heard the cars honking. You heard the a lot of loud Cuban music because the Miami Cubanos were protesting. Now, I've got a bone to pick with not you guys who are here like during the live show each day, but you know, the show streams on YouTube, and then the videos are available for anyone who wants to watch. Now, you may recall that on Friday, we dealt with what's happening in Cuba. And what I wanted to do, I got a journalist, an author, somebody who writes, you know, a lot about Cuba, to come on the show to explain, to give us facts, to tell us what's going on there. I didn't voice an opinion at all on Friday about what was going on, simply except to say that the blockade is bad and that people should be allowed to send money back to their family on the island. But if you look at some of the comments on YouTube, I don't know what they were listening to. So first, some guy named Jay Scott writes on YouTube, "There is something deeply disturbing about a woman who calls herself progressive espousing so much American propaganda on Cuba." I'm like, what is he talking about? And thankfully, there's somebody else named Solar Flares, who is obviously a listener and actually listens to what I say. And he said, why? Because she's not willing to pretend Cuba isn't a dictatorship. And then he goes back and he says, I would suggest this is that Jay Scott again. I would suggest you broaden your understanding of Cuba. Your first clue should have been Marco Rubio and Nicole hold the same views on Cuba. What?
Bullshit.
Marco Rubio and I hold the same views on anything? Yeah, I don't think so. And thanks again to Solar Flares, who said, no, they don't hold the same views. Nicole did not in any way imply that the U.S. should invade and take over Cuba. And she pointed out the embargo and remittance restrictions only hurt the Cuban population. So thank you, Solar Flares, for listening. Because then some other person comments with the name Lisa, L-E-I-S-A-D. And she writes, I used to think Nicole was informed. I can't believe she is such a shill for the South Florida fascist Cubans. What are you listening to, Lisa? Because you obviously didn't listen to a word that I said. People are protesting because the embargo is affecting them. Biden has done nothing to reverse the gross changes that Trump put in place, and the people are suffering. The rulers haven't changed. Our policies have. Yeah. I challenge both of these people to tell me, what did I say? That makes you think that I'm at all on Marco Rubio's side or sympathetic to see. Here's the thing. I don't, you know, watch the leftists of the left. I don't watch Democracy Now and then parrot back talking points. I watch and read a lot of different things. And I give my own viewpoint. So here's the thing about Cuba. We, as in the United States of America, has acted horribly in response to Cuba. I'm not a big Barack Obama fan, but I'm glad that he tried to normalize relations and open things up, because keeping Cuba isolated for the last 60-something years obviously didn't do us any good, didn't help the Cuban people. But I'm also not willing to say that the Cuban government, that the Castros were good for their people. Neither one of these governmental organizations has been particularly good for the Cuban people. But don't come on YouTube and say what I think. That's nonsense. And so anybody else who might want to listen to the show would say, oh, why should I listen to her? And I don't even know what they're saying that I said, because I didn't. Again, on Friday, I was particularly non-opinionated, just because this is such a shitty situation. Look, I hate the fact that Miami is all Cuban. I hate the fact that when I go down, cross over into Miami-Dade County, I feel like I'm going to Cuba. I feel like I'm going to another country, because frankly, I'm not fluent in Spanish. You know, I've got my basic few years of high school Spanish, but it has been overrun by the Cubans. And frankly, seeing them parading up and down our streets with their Cuban flags hanging off their cars, all I want to say is, go back. If that's your country, go back and make it better. Why are they here? But to say that I'm like rah-rahing the American what's the word I'm looking for? Putting down, you know, keeping the Cuban people down is ridiculous. Don't put words in my mouth. If you have a question on my stance on anything, I'll tell you what, why don't you call the show? I'm easily accessible. 954-889-6410 is the phone number. You can easily get through. I was neutral. Thank you, Gary. On Friday, I was more neutral than I usually ever am. I'm trying to see the other side, if there is another side. The ban on remittances, on people sending money back to their family, should be eased immediately, should be just gotten rid of. Joe Biden hasn't done that. So I don't know why, where we're at an impasse. I don't get it. Now, I do know on Friday, there was somebody in the chat room who, a regular in the chat room, who was talking about how the Castros were just wonderful leaders. No, they weren't. No, they weren't. And on that one case, you know, Castros were not innocent of anything. They were horrible to their people. That's why the Cuban people have lived the way they have for the last 60 years. So I did push back on that. Don't tell me that, that the Castro regime was good for the people and it's just, you know, America who was so oppressive. They can both be bad. And guess what? They both were bad. You feel that? They were both terrible when it came to, the Cuban people. You don't have to say one is good, therefore the other is bad. They both sucked. The American policies towards Cuba, horrible. But the Cuban policies toward the Cuban people were pretty damn bad, too. So, again, I was really neutral on Friday. So that's why I just love seeing these analyses of what I was saying. You know, some people need to get a life. All right, as do I. Okay, so I see our guest is here. As I told you, this is it's a busy, busy Monday, and I couldn't think of anyone I'd rather talk to about everything that's going on than David Dan, because he is the most prolific news writer and news passer along than anyone I know. My mouth and my brain are not working well together today, David Dan. But thank you so much for joining us. David Dan is the executive editor of the American Prospect. You can find them online at prospect.org. And his newest book is Monopolized, Life in the Age of Corporate Power. David Dan, maybe they were reading your book or Joe Biden was reading Monopolized before he released that executive order last week. Your ears must have been ringing.
There were a few books that have come out recently about concentration, but it was very heartening to see that Biden was able to put this thing together, and I think it has a lot of possibilities.
It does. And frankly, I've been surprised that I haven't seen more about this big executive order fostering competition and hopefully putting the kibosh on monopolies for a while from Joe Biden. But I've been talking about it since that happened. I had from Cory Doctorow to Zephyr Teachout to Matt Stoller. We talked about this a lot. And your name came up, I think, in each one of those interviews. So you were at the forefront. You were the reason I started thinking about monopolies in the way that I have. And, you know, obviously we've lived with them for so long and we've had antitrust laws that just hadn't been enforced in decades. So do you think this is going to start changing things? I mean, it was an executive order, but there was no law.
Well, it's a start.
It's a start.
Yeah, it's a start. I mean, the truth is that there are a lot of authorities that are already granted to the executive branch agencies under previously passed antitrust laws. A lot of those authorities just haven't been used in a long time. A good example is the Section 5 authority that the Federal Trade Commission has. And that allows them to write rules that would stop unfair methods of competition. And the FTC pretty much hasn't used Section 5 in a long time. And there were many pieces of this executive order that directed the FTC to use Section 5 authority to pass rules, for example, banning non-compete agreements or severely limiting them, which are these agreements that you sign as an employee that says, I won't, by joining and signing a contract to work for you, I will not work for anyone else in a similar industry for a period of X amount of years or whatever. And these agreements are signed by people like janitors and fast food workers.
That's amazing.
And in that instance, it's really just a wage suppression vehicle. If you are working at a fast food company and you're not allowed to work at any other fast food company for a year, it's very hard for you to bargain for higher wages, right? Because you are contractually obligated to not work for anybody else. Another Section 5 rulemaking that the FTC can do that's in the rule, that's in the executive order, is banning so-called pay-for-delay agreements in pharmaceutical arrangements. And what that means, pay-for-delay is really, it should just be called bribery.
yes.
It's when a pharmaceutical company pays a generic manufacturer to stay out of the market.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of their, you know, you get a monopoly exclusivity period if you created a drug. And at the end of that period, a drug company can just say, hey, generic, yes, theoretically, you could create a generic version now of this drug, but how about we just give you $500 million instead and you just walk away? Generic says, okay, yeah, I will do that. And this happens somewhat routinely, and it's a total mechanism is high, and to keep that entrenched monopoly power on the part of the drug maker, and the FTC has the ability to get rid of that. So so that's another example.
I should point out that today at prospect.org, you have a piece up, Biden executive order could finally lower drug prices. And you talk about a provision that was in this executive order that was kind of buried that I didn't get until I read your piece. I saw that he talked about importing drugs from Canada, that Medicare can negotiate with the pharmaceuticals. But you point out something else that is kind of buried in there. Can you explain what this is?
Yes. So it's an existing authority called march-in rights. And that sounds a little obscure, but here's what it means. Any drug that was manufactured and developed using federal money, mm-hmm. so through the National Institutes of Health, often the Defense Department does a lot of drug development, or anywhere where federal dollars are being used.
Like with the COVID vaccine, perhaps, maybe.
Yeah. So certain rights are retained by the government in those cases. And although this hasn't been used, this is a familiar refrain, right? Here's a power that hasn't been used. But although this hasn't been used, the government can seize the patents of drugs that were created using federal money and say that these aren't being issued under, quote, reasonable terms. And in the eyes of many, reasonable can mean unaffordable, right?
Mm-hmm.
Price could be one of those considerations. And so what the executive branch can do is they can take that patent and distribute it to a generic manufacturer who will then issue the drug at a more affordable rate. Okay. And this is part of a law called the Buy-Dole Act that Bob Dole and Birch Bayh, Evan Bayh's father,
wrote way back
in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been very controversial for many years whether price could be one of those reasonable terms. The drug industry said, no, price is not a consideration. Even Bayh and Dole, after they started working for the drug companies as lobbyists, they switched sides and said, no, you can't use our law to seize patents of drug companies.
Wow.
But what was going to happen is that at the end of the Trump administration, drug companies were going to get their wish. They put in motion a rule that would have banned price as a consideration in this reasonable term statute. And the Biden administration for the first several months didn't do anything to stop that. But what the executive order does is it says, please do not make any new rules under the Bayh-Dole Act on march-in rights. So that's really tipping the scales and saying that the president does retain this march-in authority to literally march in and take a patent away from a company that is excessively pricing a drug.
Wow. And this is interesting. It's even more interesting than it would be normally, because you look back on the last 4 years, and aside from Trump declaring every week infrastructure week, he also said, we're lowering prescription drug costs. He right. never did, and obviously left the door open for the exact opposite to happen.
That's right. And there's certainly a lot going on right now with respect to the infrastructure bill and the ability for a drug price reform measure to get in there. Of course, that would save the government money. Mm-hmm. So it's a way to, quote unquote, pay for infrastructure, is that you put in a strong Medicare price negotiation aspect. And that could save hundreds of billions of dollars for the government in addition to patients. And that money could be then used to offset spending on social programs or infrastructure or whatever. So that's sort of being debated right now. But what this does is say that there are executive actions under current law that don't need more congressional authority or input that can be taken right now, whether it's march-in rights or there's a reform that Trump kind of started and flirted with called international indexing, where he could say that drugs sold in the United States must meet an international benchmark of all the high-income countries, and we'll pay what they pay. It's called most favored nation status.
Okay,
so that could be an opportunity. And also, the National Institutes of Health, when they begin to provide research on drug development, in their initial contracts, they can write, this drug has to be distributed affordably. And that won't manifest itself right now into lower drug prices, but down the road, as new therapies get introduced, if the NIH has an ironclad agreement that says, you have to, you know, make this drug available in an affordable way, then that would tend to lower drug prices over time.
Right. Well, something's got to be done on that front, on so many fronts, but specifically drug prices, because they're insane. I mean, people know I have restless leg syndrome, have had it for 20 years. And right now I use this patch because nothing works on me. And the patch, without insurance, is like $700 a month for a 30-day supply. It's insane. Nobody can afford the drug. So something's got to be done there. But David Dan, so we mentioned infrastructure, and you said it's infrastructure summer. But this week, now they're back. Both the Senate was back last week. The House is just back today. They're back for a couple of weeks because they're planning on going out again for August, because Congress always takes August off. But Chuck Schumer wants to get these two infrastructure bills through. So today he filed cloture. Ostensibly, there's going to be a vote to open debate on the so-called bipartisan infrastructure bill, the BIF, on Wednesday. But now Susan Collins and some other Republicans are saying, we're not going to vote on Wednesday. We don't have a bill. We don't have text. We're not ready. And so where are we? What's going to happen here? Do we know?
Well, it's pretty common for bills to be voted on at this early stage,
yes,
on the motion to proceed,
right,
prior to legislative language being introduced.
And on the tax cuts, the Trump tax cuts, I think they opened debate before.
I don't recall.
Okay.
But it's certainly been the case that this has happened before. Schumer wants to do, I think, two things. Number one, he wants to speed up this process so that it's not endlessly strung out by, yes, Republicans the way they did with the Affordable Care Act debate, only to not agree to any of the provisions. Mm-hmm. So he's laying a marker down and saying, look, you're either going to put something together or you're not. And we need to know. And the second reason why we need to know is that the idea is, if this bipartisan bill falls apart, elements of that, all of that, would be moved into the reconciliation bill.
Right.
Well, when you put together a budget resolution, you have a headspace there of how much money you want to spend in that budget resolution, right? So if this was just going to be the reconciliation bill, the $3.5 trillion bill that Senator Sanders and Schumer talked about, then in the budget resolution, you would say this is a $3.5 trillion bill.
Right.
However, if we need room for that infrastructure bill, you have to put that in the budget resolution or else you can't do it. They need to know now, for purposes of putting together that budget resolution, they need to know exactly how much we're dealing with in that budget resolution. And therefore, they need to know whether the bipartisan bill is a go or not. And so I think that's what's accelerating the pace here.
I see. So, there's a lot of chatter on Twitter and beyond on, is Schumer going to punt the vote? Is he going to reschedule it from Wednesday, where it's scheduled now? Does he have to decide now, or can he wait till Wednesday, or can he call their bluff and just do it?
He can certainly wait till Wednesday and call their bluff. I have no intel on whether or not at this time Schumer is looking to move off, but certainly all of the rhetoric so far has been that we need to figure this out and we're giving you a deadline. And, the Republicans are whining about that because they don't like to have a deadline.
They
have wanted to endlessly kind of game this thing and string it along. I think Schumer is rightly saying, look, it's put up or shut up time.
Yeah, well, it is. And the thing is, this part of the bill, the quote, bipartisan infrastructure bill, this is the roads and the bridges and the buildings. Hello, I'm in Florida, where one collapsed and a ceiling and a roof caved in, and then other buildings have been evacuated because they've determined they're not safe. I think all over the country, people have been ready for infrastructure for a very long time. I would think it would be politically bad for the Republicans to block it. But that's me. And they don't listen to what I say. But then once they get past this, isn't there another debt ceiling fight coming up?
There is.
We went through 4 years and didn't. It seems like when the Republicans are in office, the Democrats, I guess, do the responsible thing and say, of course, you know, the debt ceiling just says we will pay the bills for the money we've already allocated. The Republicans are the ones who say, we'll let those credit cards build up. We're not going to pay our debts.
Well, they want to use it as a forcing mechanism to get something else. And so, yes, the debt ceiling was essentially suspended under Trump for a couple years.
Wow.
And that suspension ends sometime this summer, I believe next month. And it's quite unclear because, at that point, the Treasury Department can use some what they call emergency measures.
Right. To extend it.
To extend it as much as they can. But those only go so far. And now that it's been suspended for so long, it's trillions of, especially as what's happened in the last year, how much spending we've incurred. It's trillions of dollars. So there aren't that many extraordinary measures that you can take. And so the expectation is, could be as soon as next month, we're going to hit the ceiling. And that's another reason that the urgency is here, because there was some expectation or assumption or possibility that the debt ceiling would be folded into this infrastructure package, that they would deem it
taken care of, right,
for a certain amount of funds. If the debt ceiling or if the infrastructure bill doesn't come together, it's less likely that you'll see that happen. And then the question is, well, what are we going to do about the debt ceiling? And I think everybody has been studiously ignoring it at this point. It has not been a large part of the conversation. But I have always thought in the back of my mind that if there was ever a piece of legislation that would force moderate Democrats to say, okay, let's get rid of the damn filibuster, it would be the debt ceiling legislation, right? Mm-hmm. Because this is, as you correctly identified, this is literally a situation of paying the bills.
Right.
This is just getting the ability to borrow to fund things that Congress has already said that we're going to do.
That's right.
Often on a bipartisan basis. And so these moderates, the Sinemas and Mansions of the world, have to be saying to themselves, okay, we all agreed that we were going to spend this money. And now Republicans are not going to allow us to cover it and risk a financial collapse, a loss of the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. Okay, fine. Maybe this filibuster thing isn't all it's cracked up to be.
Well, then can we get them to move a little faster on it? Because we have an even more urgent, and it's hard to say one is more urgent than the other. I mean, infrastructure is urgent. Paying our bills is urgent, but voting rights is urgent. And again, you got Manchin and Sinema, but you also have others who have been conveniently quiet. They're happy to let Manchin and Sinema take the heat, but you got Maggie Hassan of New Hampshire. You got Mark Kelly of Arizona. You got John Tester, right? There's a few others who very easily could be on the fence about the filibuster. But we have this urgent situation where 40 states are in the process of or already have passed legislation to keep people who are more likely to vote Democratic from voting. And so we do need the For the People Act, and we do need the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act passed. But if the filibuster is in place, they won't be. So now there are some floating the idea of carving out an exception to the rule for constitutional issues like the right to vote. Is that something that's being talked about? Is Joe Biden tough enough? I mean, he delivered that great speech last week, but he didn't mention the word filibuster, and he didn't say how we're going to accomplish it.
Yeah, my understanding is that Senator Manchin has already said no to the carve out, and that happened over the weekend. So it doesn't look like that's going to be a possibility. As far as Biden, I mean, while rhetorically that speech was saying all the right things, as you mentioned, he didn't mention the filibuster. And to the extent that he did mention a policy at all, it was to, you know, engage in a mass registration campaign that we'll just beat them with our numbers, even though they're not letting certain elements of the Democratic coalition to vote. So I don't see a path forward really right now. I mean, you had Kamala Harris earlier than this, and you know, all the hard things have been given to Kamala Harris.
Yes. Right?
Biden says, yeah, here's something impossible here. You try to do that.
Right.
Harris kind of encouraged donors to give money to a mass registration campaign. I mean, this seems to be what they're going with as their answer. And I don't think that that's going to really do the job. To be frank, I'm more concerned. We ran a piece about this from Miles Rappaport, was one of the writers. He was the former Secretary of State of Connecticut, actually. And he said that he was more concerned. He was less concerned with the elements that literally prevent or attempt to prevent voting, because those have somewhat of a marginal significance. But he was much more concerned with the laws that commandeer election administration and give them to partisan state legislatures, in many cases, Republican state legislatures.
Right.
That, I think, is the real problem. And the bigger problem with that is, of course, even if you passed H.R. 1 and the for the and H.R. 4
does nothing.
That's not in there. Like there's no way to deal with that in there. And so that, I think, is the bigger threat. And I haven't seen a credible way on the Democratic side to deal with it.
Is anybody thinking about it? I mean, is any legislation being written? Because you would think this is more litigation than
legislation at this point. I mean, you know, there has been litigation in, I believe, the state of Florida, in the state of Georgia, in the state of Texas. But of course, the rubber meets the road with litigation at the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court has shown little or no interest in reviving any kind of voting rights. For, you know, I mean, you look at Shelby County and all of the rulings under the Roberts Court, they have all been to constrict the franchise rather than expand it.
Right. And Shelby County did away with Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And Brnovich just last week killed off Section 2, basically saying, there's no more racism. Don't worry about it. There's nothing, nobody being discriminated on the basis of race.
Right.
This is why I call it opposite world all the time, because they're living in a total, it's the upside down for people who watch Stranger Things. It's just an alternate universe. It makes no sense. So David Dayne, there's all this stuff going on. I mean, we could keep going. The COVID Delta surge. Oh my God. So you're in LA. You now have a mask mandate back in effect. I'm in Florida, where there certainly should be one, because one in every five new cases is coming from Florida. And we have an idiot governor, death sentence, I affectionately call him, whose new merchandise is T-shirts and those koozies, whatever they're called, that say, "Don't Fauci my Florida."
Right.
What? I'm so, I mean, wow.
I mean, we have known for many years that we have been living in what some people call a post-truth society.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. Where the two sides are dealing with two different sets of facts, two different sets of realities. And I think this is one of the first situations where that has become bigger than just a rhetorical bit of maddening circumstances. Like, this is very real. This is going to lead to people who could easily have their deaths prevented to happen. I mean, the vast, overwhelming majority of deaths right now are coming from the unvaccinated. And I mean, to be fair, there was always going to be a certain level of unvaccinated, but certainly the drive from conservative media organizations to diminish and weaken the arguments for the vaccine, and the silence from conservative policymakers and lawmakers in the face of that, has driven this anti-vaccination push. And the most interesting part of this to me is that these vaccines were designed, funded, and delivered by Donald Trump.
Right.
And you would think that to deny the efficacy of these vaccines would be an affront to Donald Trump himself. But no. He has flipped, you know, as usual, has done a 180. And now that he's not in power and the vaccines are associated with a government that is not him, he has turned against the vaccines that he created, that he funded. He didn't create, but he funded.
Right. He pushed.
I mean, the one good thing that Trump did, Operation Warp Speed, was it accelerated the development of these vaccines. They were issued on his watch. But for some reason, now he has decided to associate them with the Biden administration at the expense of his own followers.
Right. In fact, the Washington Post put together a great supercut last week of politicians, everyone from Ron Johnson on down the line, from when Trump was in office touting the vaccine to when Biden's in office. Basically saying, don't get it. You know, they're implanting chips or what, you know, whatever, going from one extreme to the other, just showing the hypocrisy. But it's and then today.
And, I mean, even more along those lines, I was just watching this. Our friend Ryan Grimm from The Intercept, who's now over at Rising, talked about how Fox News has an internal program within their company, which is a vaccine passport, where you cannot show up to work without a mask unless you got the vaccine at Fox. So it's okay for them to, you know, destroy individual freedoms of employees at Fox by saying you either get the vaccine or you don't show up to work. But the message that they're broadcasting is that that is tyranny. That kind of setup would be the death of freedom. That kind of setup would be an unconscionable impingement on your rights.
Yeah.
Everything you thought you knew, you never knew it all. Sideways is straight ahead. Facts no longer matter. Reality is now fiction. There's a signpost up ahead. Your next stop, Opposite World.
It's Opposite World. And today on Fox and Fiends, Steve Ducey said, you get your vaccines, it'll save a life. And apparently the kickback was so massive. But, you know, I don't watch Fox, but what I'm reading is, I guess throughout the day today, some of the hosts have been saying you need to get vaccinated. Something changed over the weekend.
So something must change. But let's see what their nighttime anchors who get the most viewers,
exactly,
what they say.
Now,
I doubt it will be the same.
How does Tucker Carlson stay on the air? Is it just that, you know, he gets eyeballs, so they keep him and they don't? It's so irresponsible. And I make the, you know, the distinction all the time that this is a cable channel, so the FCC has no jurisdiction. If it were one of the Fox-owned television stations and this were one of their 11 o'clock news programs, he couldn't get away with it because the station license could be challenged and hopefully would be.
Well, it could get away with it, but shouldn't be able to. For an owned and operated, it would be true, but...
Right.
You know, I mean, Sinclair Broadcasting owns hundreds of these,
and they do it.
These channels across the country, and they don't, you know, follow the same rules.
Right. So. That's true. There is no mechanism for going after the so-called Fox News channel because it's cable channel and the FCC doesn't have jurisdiction. They do have jurisdiction over individual station licenses, but someone's got to challenge it and then they've got to win the case. So there's a mechanism there, not that anything's actually done about them. So let me ask you this. What the hell, Merrick Garland? We learn that he's not going to prosecute Wilbur Ross, who lied under oath, who did many other things as commerce director that were on the other side of ethical. But he lied under oath, and he's going to suffer no consequences for that? Our Justice Department will not pursue that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that by and large, if you were to grade Joe Biden on his personnel appointments, you know, he'd get pretty decent marks. But there's no question that Merrick Garland would be, you know, at the bottom of the list, and for a variety of reasons, not just the fact that he isn't going forward on these clear violations of law. He has been actively fighting the various appointments that would be more progressive inside the Justice Department, including the Assistant Attorney General for Antitrust.
Yeah, that hasn't even been named yet.
Which hasn't been made yet. I mean, this is an important thing about that executive order, by the way, is that many of the agencies that are needed to carry out the executive order don't have personnel in place. So the Justice Department's antitrust division, there's no head of that right now. The FCC, which is supposed to restore net neutrality, according to the executive order, only has four people on it right now, two Democrats and two Republicans. There's a vacant fifth spot. Biden hasn't appointed anyone for it. Even the Federal Trade Commission, right now it has a 3-2 split, Democrats to Republicans. But Rohit Chopra, who's one of the commissioners of the FTC, has been nominated to run the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Right.
And so as soon as
he'll
leaves, you'll have that 2-2 split again. And Biden hasn't nominated anyone to replace Chopra. So the problem with the executive order, to the extent there is one, is follow through, is actually getting the people in place to carry it out. And that's very true at the Justice Department. And my understanding is that it's been Garland who has been fighting the ability to get a better nominee in place. And so in the midst of that fighting, there's just been a deadlock. And so we've seen this in several positions across the Justice Department. We had a piece last week by our friends at the Revolving Door Project about that very issue, about vacancies at DOJ. But, you know, you combine all these vacancies with the reticence to take any kind of major stand on issues of public significance, like the previous administration's lies and violations of law.
Yeah.
And you have a kind of an inert agency. I mean, it's not only that, right? It's that DOJ has actively taken the side of Trump officials in various cases. There's
representing Trump against E. Jean Carroll, her defamation.
Right, that was one. And there was another one with respect to Betsy DeVos, where the DOJ official weighed in on the side of DeVos in the dispute that she had over student loans.
Wow.
So you've seen this pattern over and over again, and you know, I think Garland is taking this concept that I am going to be 100% different than the attorney generals under Trump. I'm not going to take orders from the president. I'm not going to, you know, act as the president's lawyer, and all of that is fine, right? But there's a difference between saying I'm not going to act as the president's lawyer and then I'm going to studiously ignore violations of law because I would be seen as acting as the president's lawyer, right? I mean, like, that is a real problem, because now you're just pushing this attitude that is undermining your own mission as the top law enforcement official in the country.
Right. There's also the issue of, and this isn't the Justice Department, but the post office. DeJoy is still there, and Biden needs to do personnel stuff to get him out of there and hasn't. And I can tell you firsthand, as somebody who uses the post office a lot, it sucks. I've had two things disappear in the last week and a half alone. So I know that's anecdotal, but still, it's just horrible. So, you know, there's a lot of things like that.
I mean, with respect to the post office, it's an interesting position. So Biden did name three additional members of the Postal Service Board of Governors. There are now five Democrats on that board, and they do have a majority on the Postal Service Board, yet nothing is happening. And the reason nothing is happening is only the Board of Governors can fire the Postmaster General, right? Mm-hmm. So the idea was Biden nominates governors, the governors fire the Postmaster General. Well, the two holdover Democrats support Louis DeJoy. I mean, they have said it in open testimony before Congress. Ron Blum and Donald Moak, Blum said it outright in testimony before Congress. I think that DeJoy is doing a good job.
Oh my God.
And Moak has privately said it according to published reports. So you're not going to get DeJoy out under the current makeup of the Board of Governors. And the tough spot that Biden's in is that Blum is supported by the National Association of Letter Carriers, who is one of the top postal unions. And it would be difficult politically for Biden to go against the top postal union and throw out Blum, who is actually the chair of the Board of Governors as we speak right now. So the question becomes, you know, what do you do? I mean, this is why a lot of Democrats have said you have to fire the entire Board of Governors.
Right.
You need to fire them all right now and put in people who have the foresight to say that Louis DeJoy destroyed the post office over the last year and he needs to go. Biden has not done that. The situation with the union is one of the reasons. But until something like that is done, you're going to have Louis DeJoy around there.
That's horrible. I mean, he said it publicly. I'm going to make it more expensive and I'm going to slow it down. That should be enough right there to say, no, he's the wrong guy. David Dayan, I've been throwing issue after issue at you. Is there anything that I didn't bring up that you're concerned about or think we should all be keeping an eye on?
I don't know. Those are we covered quite a lot. I think we covered the main stuff.
We did.
I don't do a lot of international coverage anymore, but we personally, but we do at The Prospect. And obviously, we're looking at things like the situation in Haiti and the situation in the Middle East and
Cuba,
the pullout of Afghanistan. And we cover that pretty extensively through our managing editor, Jonathan Geyer. So a lot happening on the foreign policy side. It's not talked about as much anymore. But I do think that we need to keep that top of mind.
Absolutely. Again, I'm going to tout the American Prospect at prospect.org. I love that you operate the way I do. You're obviously on a bigger scale, but there's no paywall there. Just like I don't have a paywall there. You subsist on subscriptions and donations, as do I.
Yes. prospect.org/donate.
Yes.
You can go.
Definitely.
We have a membership program. It's like a small monthly fee, and you get the magazine, you get access to the website. There are other perks. Last week, we did our first what we call the Politics and Power Hour, where we had a private conversation between members and myself.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a lot of things to offer, also newsletters and things like that.
Absolutely.
Things that come to your email box. Prospect.org.
And more with all these sites going to a paid model where you know, you can read three articles and then they right. hit you with the paywall. You have great writers. You have great reporting. You cover Thanks. Everything. And the fact that you're not behind a paywall, I so respect. I'm one of your biggest fans.
We try to do it on the honor system, and we hope that people like the work and will support it. But we don't want it to be a situation where the information is restricted in any way.
Absolutely. And I really appreciate that because there are a lot of people still really hurting that just can't afford it. Just like I think right. they can't afford to pay for a radio
right.
show.
So the
if
people,
they can, who can, yeah. will.
The people who can support it to make, keep it free for everybody.
Yeah. Absolutely. David Dayan, again, find him on Twitter at ddayan and at prospect.org. Read it daily. You'll be more informed. Thank you so much, David. It's always great to talk to you, and I so appreciate
All right,
your time.
Thanks a lot.
All right, you too.
Take
Bye-bye.
Care.
All right, bye. David Dayan, I'm telling you, back, you know, when I was just starting the show, I kept him on a lot longer than I was going to. When I was starting the show, back in the, before the Air America days, you know, I did mornings on WINZ here in Miami, and then I was on Air America. Back then, he wrote the news for Fire Dog Lake, which was in the day of the, you know, the OG blogger days. And he was always like the most prolific news writer. He'd have something on everything, like every big story. And then when Fire Dog Lake ended, he went freelance and was everywhere. You'd see him writing for The Nation, to Truth Out, to Salon, to, you know, you name it. He just kept up that pace of writing. And then when he became executive editor of the American Prospect, what a great fit, because it was always a good magazine, but now it's like an important daily stop in your online reading. So do check that out. All right, so we've got we don't have much time left. We've got like seconds left. So I guess let's tell you tomorrow's Tuesday, and yes, Gotta Laugh will be here. Laffy is back. She's, you know, still dealing with hand issues, but she's now doing an every other week thing, and tomorrow is the week, the on week. So Laffy will be here tomorrow. Not sure what we're doing Wednesday yet. I've got a couple of possibilities. Later on in the week, I'm supposed to be speaking with Michael C. Bender. Now, over the last week and a half, you've seen him everywhere. He's a Wall Street Journal reporter, and he's got one of those new books. I forget the title, but, you know, one of the new Trump books with page after page of revelations. And it's not a vicarious thing. It's not like, oh, my God, he did that. But we need to know what went on while Trump was in office, to protect ourselves from something like that happening again, if that's at all possible. But the question I have for Michael C. Bender and for the Washington Post reporters who's coming on the following week, who have the other book out, is why weren't these stories released as news as soon as you learned about them? I mean, where's the line? Where is the cutoff between the news, the newsworthiness, and waiting for the book? And how do you decide? Well, this one can wait. But this one is urgent, so it needs to come out now. I think a lot of these things that we learned about, especially Mark Milley and his reaction to the Lafayette Square thing, we probably should have known about that a lot earlier. One of the questions I'll ask. Because they've been doing so many interviews, I've got to find the questions that nobody yet has asked. So that's what I'm looking for. All right, we are at the end of the hour. Thanks for listening, everybody. I truly appreciate it. And those of you who can afford it, I hope you'll support the program because it's how I get by. Until tomorrow, thanks for listening. Be good. Take care. And wear a mask. All right? Okay. All right. Bye. I'll leave you with the news because I didn't do it before the show started. I was, no, that's like the new thing I was going to start. Play it at the beginning. And I know we said that on Friday, and of course I forgot. So we'll do it now. Here's the news.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, said Sunday that he backs the reinstatement of mask mandates in response to local increases in coronavirus cases. He stressed the importance of debunking the disinformation spreading on the internet and telling the truth.
After this very difficult year we've been through, people deserve to have access to accurate information. They deserve to hear that from their leaders. They deserve to hear that from the media. They deserve to see that on platforms online. And they need that information to be able to make decisions to protect themselves and their families. That's the least we can do for them. And my worry is that all this is misinformation that's floating around. It's having a real cost that can be measured in lives lost, and that is just tragic.
Los Angeles County on Sunday put its new mask mandate into effect, requiring both vaccinated and unvaccinated to wear face coverings indoors, at businesses, and in public places. The decision came a month after the previous mask mandate was lifted. Los Angeles is the first major U.S. county to reinstate its mask mandate after the broad reopening that followed this year's sharp drop in COVID-19 infections, hospitalizations, and deaths. Coronavirus cases have jumped following the loosening of restrictions as the highly transmissible Delta variant spread rapidly, especially in areas with low vaccination rates. So you know the group of Texas House Democrats who left the state in order to prevent the Republicans from achieving a quorum that they need in order to pass new state voting restrictions. Well, two more of them have now tested positive for COVID-19, bringing the number to five who've tested positive on the trip. The members were reportedly fully vaccinated. The group is in Washington, D.C., seeking meetings with members of Congress to push for federal voting rights legislation, including the For the People Act, to counter new voting restrictions being pushed by a lot of Republican-controlled state legislatures. COVID is also affecting Olympic athletes. Sadly, tennis player Coco Gauff from down here in South Florida, she announced Sunday that she too tested positive for COVID-19 and would not play in the Tokyo Olympics. Gauff said the news was a huge disappointment, tweeting, quote, "It's always been a dream of mine to represent the U.S. at the Olympics, and I hope there will be many more chances for me to make this come true in the future." The 17-year-old had been expected to lead the U.S. in the first Olympics in 25 years without either Serena or Venus Williams playing for the team. Now it's up to U.S. tennis players Jennifer Brady, Jessica Pegula, and Allison Risk to represent the U.S. in women's singles. The Washington Post reported on Sunday that Israeli military-grade spyware known as Pegasus was used to hack 37 smartphones of journalists, human rights activists, and business executives. Among those targeted, the fiancé of murdered Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The journalists' and activists' phones were on a list shared with the Post by Paris-based journalism nonprofit Hidden Stories and the human rights group Amnesty International. It included more than 50,000 numbers in countries known to spy on people. The Israeli company, the NSO Group, denied the report's findings. And in a sidebar story, the Washington Post proclaimed that Apple's iPhone, considered to be the gold standard for security features, is shown to be vulnerable to spyware intended for tracking terrorists. Well, everything they warned would happen as a result of climate change is now happening. Floods doing serious damage in Europe, landslides destroying neighborhoods in India, and fire now decimating large swaths of the United States. At least 189 people are dead and hundreds more still missing after this catastrophic flooding that hit Western Europe. Caused by unprecedented rainfall, the flooding hit parts of Western Germany before shifting to Belgium and the Netherlands. In the U.S., 80 large fires have been raging in 13 states, burning more than a million acres. And officials in Oregon are warning more residents to prepare to evacuate as the bootleg fire scorches about 300,000 acres. And at least 31 people have been killed in Mumbai after torrential rain triggered landslides that crushed cars and houses in India. German Chancellor Angela Merkel is back home and on Sunday visited a village destroyed in the floods. As Merkel met with survivors and thanked volunteers, she said the destruction was surreal and eerie and said, quote, "The German language has no words, I think, for the devastation." Merkel promised that the government would help to rebuild the infrastructure. Rescue teams continue to look for victims as heavy rains caused further flooding in the southern German region of Bavaria. German meteorologists said the flooding was the worst in at least 500 years. Hundreds of residents are forced to flee Lake Tahoe as wildfires spread rapidly to cover 30 square miles. It's the Tamarack Fire, which is still 0% contained. This fire was started by lightning on July 4th and has just continued growing since then. So there's disease, fire, and now let's talk guns. Shootings over the weekend in Chicago, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., and other U.S. cities underscored the continuing rise in gun violence across the country this year. In Washington, D.C., outside of Nationals Park, the sound of gunshots sent fans and players running for safety as a game was being played. Three people were wounded. In Chicago, at least 53 were shot in 41 separate shootings between Friday and Sunday night. And in Portland, Oregon, a woman died and six others were wounded after a shooting on Saturday. Other shootings injured children, including a one-year-old wounded Saturday night in Philadelphia. And things come to a head this week. In Congress, the House is back from their July 4th recess and, of course, are preparing to leave again in August. Meanwhile, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is trying to get infrastructure done before that happens. He's scheduling two major deadlines this week to force action on Joe Biden's agenda. So here's how it should work. Schumer files cloture Monday on the so-called bipartisan infrastructure deal, whether or not the final text has been drafted. That'll set up a procedural vote on the bill 30 hours later, putting Republicans on record for the first time Wednesday, even as they continue negotiating on the final language. Senators in the group spent this past weekend trying to fix the pay-fors. Republicans, led by Rob Portman of Ohio, took issue with the plans to beef up IRS enforcement as one solution. But apparently the group was still haggling over something in almost every category of the bill, from highways and transit to water and power infrastructure. Schumer reportedly thinks both sides have had plenty of time to reach an agreement, but this will be a busy week. Schumer also expects to have all 50 Senate Democrats, that means including Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, committed to the unified budget plan this week. Passage of the $3.5 trillion budget is needed for them to be able to invoke reconciliation, in which they only need 50 votes plus one. If they don't get all 50 votes, it could all fall apart. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is fully listener-supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.